If you're enjoying these episodes of Yankton's Yardbirds, join us on our support site called buymeacoffee.com. Please consider clicking the Support the Show link included in the description of each show. You can choose to donate $5, $10, $15, or $20, or you can become a member. Members will receive extra content that will be added as the shows progress. This will include pictures of the vets, audio interviews, maps, write-ups, and much more content that will be available to members only. Please consider making a donation or becoming a member soon. And as always, thank you for listening to Yankton's Yardbirds. This episode of Yankton's Yardbirds is brought to you by Stephanie Tamasia Interiors. Steph will provide you with full-service interior design. From new construction to creating that dream room, she can assist you with all aspects of design and construction process, as well as furniture, window coverings, art, and accessories. Stephanie Tamasia Interiors. Live in beauty and comfort.
Welcome to Yankton's Yardbirds, a podcast presenting the World War II stories of Yankton's veterans. After 165 interviews and countless hours of preparation, it's time to share these stories. As of now, they'll be shared by podcast and later will be presented in print. If you have questions, free to contact me at davidhosmer@hotmail.com. Please be advised that there is some offensive language within these interviews. When I'm speaking, I've edited my language to more modern times. In early December, Japanese planes flew over Clark Field for several days, so all American forces in the Philippines were placed on full alert. Full alert to the men in the Air Corps meant that every American plane was on the runway and guarded 24 hours a day. Because of the location of the Philippines relative to the international dateline, the Americans on Luzon heard about the sneak attack at Pearl Harbor on the 8th of December at about 3 a.m. Amazingly, Admiral Thomas Hart, the commander of the Asiatic Fleet, received notice of the attack and did not tell General MacArthur, the commander of the Far East Army Forces. A lower-ranked Army official heard of the attack while listening to a commercial radio broadcast and told MacArthur at about 3:45 in the morning. About 15 minutes later, MacArthur's chief of staff, Richard Sutherland, told General Lewis Brereton of the attack. MacArthur was Brereton's superior officer. The prior evening, there'd been a party, which all of the B-17 pilots attended. It had just ended a few hours earlier. Within the hour, Brereton asked Sutherland to grant him permission to scramble those pilots located at Clark Field. Brereton wanted to attack Japanese planes located at Formosa. MacArthur did not reply, but Sutherland told him to prepare and stand by. At 5:30 in the morning, acting on orders from General Marshall in Washington, MacArthur ordered that the recently revised and more aggressive Rainbow 5 be implemented. However, MacArthur's plan to fight the Japanese at the water's edge was over before it began. An enduring mystery is MacArthur's failure to immediately send the Air Corps into action. The revised Rainbow 5 plan did include aerial attacks. According to Robert Phillips, who was a crew chief and flight engineer at Clark Field, MacArthur's, quote, army was not on a huggy-huggy basis with the Air Force, unquote. But that's not sufficient. According to President Quezon, MacArthur believed that the Philippines might still be spared from attack, so he held his planes back. That may be true, but by 6:15 a.m., MacArthur knew that the Japanese had bombed Malag and Davao, a Filipino island. MacArthur and Sutherland blamed Brereton because he lacked advanced reconnaissance. Luck was even on the American side. The Japanese attack at Luzon had been delayed several hours due to weather on Luzon, and the attacking Japanese planes in Formosa were fogged in, which sent the Japanese into their own panic mode because they suspected MacArthur knew about the attack at Pearl and would certainly retaliate. Warren Jorgensen, who was at Longapo, was awakened very early that morning. Quote, we had an early reveille. I think it was about 4 a.m., he said. They assembled in an orderly fashion in the pitch-black darkness so they could march to the Navy tug, which would convey them and their equipment to another Filipino city, Marvelas, located on the tip of the Bataan Peninsula. There was some optimism in the air. One of his buddies, Darren Grunewald, who hailed from Wisconsin, suggested, quote, "This is a hell of a day. We're over the hump. It's all downhill from here," unquote. They had enlisted on December 8th, 2 years prior, and had two more years until their enlistment was complete. All of a sudden, a Marine driving a motorcycle with a sidecar drove by and shouted, "Oahu has been bombed by the Japanese!" Warring didn't pay much attention because it was slightly confusing. America had a gunship named the USS Oahu. Too bad, he thought. The Japs got that ship. However, within minutes thereafter, the office of the day passed on the bicycle and declared, "War's been declared!" According to Warren, the silence was deafening. As a result of the full alert, Robert Phillips was roused very early and walked onto a runway at Clark Field. He was required to stand beside his plane, which was located along the jungle across from his barracks. As he stood there, he was told a rumor. The Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, and soon enough, a radio man confirmed the story. Phillips was stunned. He wasn't even supposed to be at Clark Field. After basic training, he was stationed at Chanute Field in Rantoul, Illinois. A friend approached him and announced that he had just been ordered overseas, but he had a girlfriend, and he didn't want to go. Would Bob consider trading places with him? Would he like to go to the Philippines? Sure. And that is why Bob stood on a dirt airfield on Luzon in the early hours of the 8th of December. Not far away from Phillips was Walter Straka, who was also on duty as a result of the full alert. Company A of the 194th Tank Battalion, stationed at nearby Fort Stotzenberg, was instructed to guard the north end of Clark Field. There were supposed to be at least two men in each tank at all times. The tankers had only recently been given their M3 Stuart light tanks. According to Walter, the first time he even saw such a tank was after he arrived in Manila a few months prior. This is clear evidence that the Americans were unprepared for battle. At 17:15 a.m., Brereton again sought permission to attack the Japanese at Formosa, but the reply from MacArthur's office was that America could not make the first, quote, overt act, unquote. Brereton was enraged. He roared, "Damn it! Wasn't the bombing of Pearl Harbor an overt act?" Chief of the Air Corps, Henry Hap Arnold, ordered him to disperse his planes, so he scrambled 36 P-40s and the B-17s. Finally, at 8 a.m., Brereton was ordered to prepare several B-17s for, quote, daylight missions, unquote. Although the Air Corps didn't know it, Japanese planes were already on their way to bomb Baguio, located 105 miles north of Clark Field. 2 hours later, MacArthur finally ordered Brereton to attack the Japanese in Formosa. All the circling American planes were told to land, to refuel, and to arm for the mission. Even the P-40s, which provided air cover, were ordered to land. Quote, "I didn't know about the order to attack until later," said Phillips. "The air crew wasn't arming my airplane." The circling planes began to land at about 11:30 a.m. At about 11:20 a.m., radar located at Nichols Field spotted a large mass of planes at Iba Airfield, which is 145 miles away from Clark Field. The air raid sirens at Nichols Field were triggered, but there were no sirens wailing at Clark Field. The radio operators there did not receive the message because there were no open communication lines. Clark's sirens remained silent. All of the planes were still in line to be refueled. Beginning at 12:45 p.m., the Japanese attacked in three waves of 108 heavy bombers, dive bombers, and 84 Zeros. Phillips saw the planes. They were in two triangular formations of 27 planes coming from the north. He saw bombs falling, and he ran toward a trailer and crawled underneath it. It wasn't until after the attack that he realized it was a gas trailer. American pilots tried to taxi down the runway and were strafed. Some pilots made it aloft, but they were shot down too. The hour-long attack was incredibly successful. 16 of the 17 B-17s on the ground at Clark Field were destroyed or damaged, along with 34 P-40s. Two B-17s safely returned from a recon mission. The tankers were helpless against the planes. Walter's tank driver, Arvid Danielson, was hit and nearly died. Walter stopped the bleeding with his shirt, thereby saving his life. 80 men died. Jorgensen and the other Marines at Alangapo wondered if the news changed their plans, but the officers talked it over and they proceeded. The USS Vega transported them to Mariveles. As the ship headed down the coast, the sailors listened to the radio. After the information was broadcast, it was relayed about the ship. They were near their destination at about noon when they heard the drone of airplanes. They looked up into the blue sky. They didn't know it, but those 36 glistening Japanese bombers were returning to Formosa after dropping their bombs on Nichols Field. It was at that moment that the men were shaken into reality. The presence of Japanese bombers verified the war was on its way. As his voice crackled during our interview, Warren said, "This is no drill. It really hit you then." The 8th was a Monday, and Nick Sawi was in his high school classroom when Japanese planes bombed an oil refinery outside San Fernando. Quote, "We saw smoke rising not too far from the high school," he said. The principal dismissed the school because a war had started. Nick and his sister left school and returned to Aguilar. Their father was distraught. Many people thought the war would be over soon because the Americans were so powerful, but this was only wishful thinking. Within a few days, Nick's family moved 2 miles away from their lovely home in Aguilar. Their home was too close to Lingayen, and their father suspected the Japanese would drive down the highway on their way to Manila. They built a simple hut in a forested area in the northern part of the Zambales Mountains, and 14 family members lived there for 3 months. They slept on bamboo arranged on the floor. They ate only dried food, including a hog, and drank water from the rivers. They built something akin to a 5-foot-deep air raid shelter. The primitive lifestyle was difficult, but Nick now has a sense of humor about it. One day someone yelled, "The Japanese are coming!" They all jumped into the shelter only to see a gigantic snake, and then they all jumped out just as fast. One fact is clear. After the Americans in Manila heard of the attack at Pearl Harbor, they had a 9-hour window to attack, and they did very little, which has created lasting questions. Why didn't Hart immediately tell MacArthur? Why didn't MacArthur authorize offensive action sooner? And why didn't Brereton order air cover during the arming process? On the other hand, look at the Japanese efficiency. They simultaneously attacked the Allied troops in Hong Kong, Malaya, Singapore, Guam, Wake Island, and Thailand. They also attacked the American embassy at Tientsin in China. 203 Marines surrendered. Quote, "I knew some of those guys in Peking and Tientsin," said Jorgensen. "I went through boot camp with them," unquote. And he never saw them again.
If you are interested in sponsoring an episode of Yankton's Yardbirds, please contact David Hosmer at davidhosmer@hotmail.com. All content for this podcast was created by David Hosmer, and all production was performed by Eric Berenger. Thank you for listening to this episode of Yankton's Yardbirds.